For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
To our study of the book of Hebrews, we're in chapter 11, the probably most famous chapter in the Bible on the subject of faith. We could call this series of studies Faith in Practice because Hebrews goes back through the whole Old Testament, scanning from one end to the other, and studies the question of faith using biography, actual life experiences, as one of the best ways to understand how faith should work out in life. In verse 13, after going over, you know, Abraham and Sarah, Abel, various figures of faith that we've already talked about, he points out that all these faithful ones died without receiving what God had promised them, but they saw it all from a distance and welcomed the promises of God. They agreed that they were no more than foreigners and nomads here on earth. And obviously, people who talk like that are looking forward to a country they can call their own. If they had met the country they came from, they could have found a way to go back. But they were looking for a better place, a heavenly homeland. That's why God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a heavenly city for them. So this whole issue that came up, you know, at the first verse of the chapter, faith being the assurance of things not seen, faith is most evident when we live in a posture of trust of God, even though we're not being gratified at the moment. The thing that we're hoping to get from God hasn't happened yet. We're waiting, but we believe it's real still off in the future. This is really the whole issue of the temporal versus the eternal value system. That's what he's talking about. These guys, you know, Abraham, we saw, was a man of privilege. He could have gone back to Ur. He could have saved himself from living like that out there, like a nomad. But he believed in this future with God. And so even though he never received the promised land personally in his life, he believed the unseen was real, that it really is there, and that he was going to be with God, and that was good enough for him. Tonight, we're going to study two more figures that he gets into, Joseph and Moses. And these contain lessons for people who are interested in serving God, carrying out a mission. Not that Abraham wasn't that way, but you know, he kind of had to withstand all of his stuff sort of out there on his own with his family. And we've moved down a little bit in history now later, and now there's a whole community of people. And so God needs leaders, needs those who are going to step forward and try to move His mission forward in the world. And that whole area of serving God also centers around the notion of faith. Faith is central to being successful in serving God. Let's start out thinking about Joseph. We read in verse 22 that it was by faith that Joseph, when he was about to die, confidently spoke of God's bringing the people out of Egypt. He was so sure of it that he commanded them to carry his bones with them when they left. Well, he's kind of jumped to the end of the story here of Joseph. This has happened right near his death. Let's go back and review a little bit and kind of bring us up to this point. Joseph is introduced to us. This is a long story in Genesis. There's 10 chapters long that this story goes, so we're not going to have time to read the story. We find that he was Jacob's favorite son out of 12 sons. Joseph was the favorite one. That he was a brilliant guy, handsome. He was cut, built well, a favorite with the ladies. He must have been charismatic. Everywhere he went, he always seemed to rise to the top very quickly. People were drawn to him. He was magnetic. Whether it was in prison, he would wind up being put in charge of all the other prisoners. Wherever he was always, people recognized, this is the kind of guy people will follow. He was spiritually gifted. He had the ability to interpret visions and dreams, and he could get messages from God that way. So that was a pretty important thing too. And yet, we read that he spent around 20 years of his life in complete and total futility. Now, this is kind of a real stark part of the story. he had a vision that God wanted to use him for something, and it had to do with these sheaves and the stars and moons and all this, and he interpreted it a certain way and blew shot his mouth off to his brothers, offended them. They were jealous of him anyway because he was their dad's favorite kid. And they just reached a breaking point. They grabbed him and they sold him as a slave. The Midianites' caravan carried him down to Egypt, and there he was sold into a household of a wealthy Egyptian named Potiphar. He serves as a slave. Next thing you know, Potiphar recognizes something special about this guy. He puts him in charge of his whole household. He was his steward. Says that Potiphar didn't even worry about how much money he had. Just let Joseph take care of everything. So he becomes the manager for the household, just like he always does. Long about a little while comes along, Potiphar's wife says, yeah, she wants some of that action too. She wants him to sleep with her. Lie with me, she says. No. You know, I'm being trusted here. Your husband's given everything into my hand except for you. You know, and there's no way I'm going to do that. She seizes him. Come on. And he tears away from her, leaving his cloak in her hand. She didn't like that. So she was angry, you know, the wrath of a woman scorned. Well, she had that cloak there, so she used that and started to cry out and said, this Hebrew slave tried to rape me. Look, he's left his cloak here and ran when I screamed. And that's about all it took to convict in that day. And so Potiphar hears this. He was furious. He throws Joseph in prison. And there he rots, year in, year out. Oh, the years are just going by. All he's doing is sitting in prison. The jailer noticed there was something special about him. He's like, this guy, yeah. And so he made him he put him in charge of all the other prisoners and stuff. Joseph became the prison administrator. But, you know, you had to wonder, by now, you know, 10, 12, 15 years have gone by. Nothing's happening. It's as if, you know, where's God in this guy's life? First he's a slave. Now he's sitting in prison because he did the right thing, because he wouldn't do the wrong thing. Now he's sitting in prison because of that. Where's the fairness here? God, hello? Boy, this would be hard to take. Finally, there's a break in the action. These two guys, other prisoners there, one of them was Pharaoh's cupbearer, one of them was his baker. They had dreams, and someone told them, you know, that guy over there has the ability to tell what dreams mean. He can get visions and messages from that. So they're like, so what do these dreams mean? And he gives them their future. He tells them what the meaning of their dreams are. And both of them are going to be taken out of the prison pretty soon. One of them gets wasted. The other one gets restored to his position. He tells the one that's going to get restored, he says, remember me when you get your freedom. I'm here unfairly. See if you can get Pharaoh to let me out. Well, the guy goes out and says he promptly forgot all about Joseph. And just when it seemed like, man, so after, you know, 10 years of rotting in prison, this was a break in the action, something actually happening. There's evidence of spiritual, you know, God speaking again. And then he just sits in there for another 2 years. This to me, this part right here is where the story reaches its limit of pathos. If I just put myself in Joseph's place, I can't imagine just sitting there. Once again, my hopes were up. Maybe God's still involved in my life. A whole year goes by, a whole another year. How do you maintain faith in God in those kind of conditions? By now, around 20 years have passed since he was a boy and was sold as a slave. Well, all of a sudden, Pharaoh has a disturbing dream. He can't get any rest. He's going crazy with his magicians. What does this dream mean? And finally, this cupbearer's like, hey, you know, come think of it. I know a guy that can interpret dreams. He told me the future. He's down there in prison. Pharaoh's like, get him up here. They'd bring him up. He gives the Pharaoh the interpretation to his dream. It's about a big famine that's coming. He's got the answer, how to withstand the famine and everything else. Great plan. Pharaoh says, you know, this is awesome. That you knew what the dream was and what it meant. You're in charge. I'm going to put you in charge of this whole project. So they saved up grain for 7 years in preparation for the famine that was to come after that. And Joseph went from being a slave and a prisoner to being the second in command in Egypt. Pharaoh says, you'll be second only to me down here. And so he's one of the most powerful men in the world overnight. Well, he ends up rescuing his entire family because the famine hits up where they are too. This is now 7 more years later. There's no food, and you know, this kind of thing happened in the ancient world. When a harvest failed, people starved. There just was nothing to fall back on. But Egypt had been saving grain for 7 years in warehouses. And everyone heard, if you have to have food, go down to Egypt. They've got it down there. And so they send these guys down. He winds up, I'm going to cut the story short. Anyway, he brings his family down. They are fed. Pharaoh is happy because Joseph is happy. He gives them the land to live in, an area called Goshen, right there in the delta of the Nile River. It's like some of the best land in the Mediterranean. Fertile, good, kind of isolated by rivers from the rest of Egypt. Over the course of the next 400 years, God takes this clan of 50 to 70 people and multiplies them into a nation. They change from a family into a nation during this time, sort of incubated out in this Goshen area there. The Egyptians would avoid them. They wanted nothing to do with them because it says that in the text, the Egyptians hate shepherds, so they would avoid the Jews. So different than the Canaanites, who they lived among before, who were eager to hang out with them, intermarry with them, exchange ideas and religions and everything else. They were constantly in danger of being contaminated and led astray by the Canaanites, whereas in Egypt, the Egyptians just left them alone. It was a perfect setup. You finally realize, God must have had this all under control. This must have all been kind of a setup here. There was never a point where God lost the thread. You couldn't have told that if you were Joseph. Joseph must have thought, man, God forgot what he was doing. I thought he was going to use me in some kind of plan or whatever, but that was 20 years ago. Nothing's happened except disaster since then. But God was actually at work the whole time, wasn't he? Yeah. And so there is a lesson here. There is a lesson here. There's probably several lessons that we could learn from this. If you're into serving God, you're also into waiting. You know, the fruit was ultimately born here, but I've had to wait sometimes for fruitfulness and for God to use me. I have a heart to be used by God in this world. And he's used me before at times, but then it seems like these lengthy times go by where you can't get anything done. Very frustrating. Everyone you talk to, nobody's listening. People losing it right and left. You know, it can be pretty frustrating. And God has called on me at times to wait. Never like this, frankly. Never 20 years. Even in 1 year, it's pretty hard to take. 1 or 2, that's pretty bad. Well, this incident happened after, you know, the Jews had been rescued and located in Goshen there, and Joseph was still looking ahead and saying, the day is going to come when we're going back up into Israel. So when we do, I'll probably be dead by then. So you can just take my bones up and bury them where they belong, up in the promised land. He knew that God was going to continue to work. And so we have that's the story of Joseph. Then we have the story of Moses. Oh, he's one of the real famous leaders in the Old Testament. Hebrews says about him, it was by faith that Moses' parents hid him for 3 months when he was born. They saw that God had given them an unusual child, and they were not afraid to disobey the king's command. And so at the birth of Moses, I think what's implied here is the choosing of God, that God marked him right there. You're going to be my man, and you're going to do things for me. The command of the king, of Pharaoh, was that all male children had to be killed. And Moses was a male child. Well, they hid him for 3 months, and when they could hide him no longer, it says, then they put him out into a basket. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Here's the interesting thing. So Moses was a chosen guy. He was chosen by God to be a leader. Not chosen in the sense like some people think God chooses some people to go to heaven and chooses others to go to hell. That's not what's going on here at all. Rather, that Moses was chosen for a particular role, a mission. That he was to be a leader for God. Now, this became apparent much later, after he had left Egypt and was up in the area of Midian. We read that one day he was out shepherding his sheep and he saw this bush on fire, but it didn't seem to burn up, so he went over there and it was God. And God spoke to Moses from the burning bush. He says, "Moses, I'm going to have you go down and rescue your people, because by now the Egyptians had turned against the Jews and enslaved them, so they were slaves." Interesting thing to notice about Moses, you know, he was a man of faith, no question about that. But Moses was not a perfect man, far from it. When God said to him in Exodus 3, "Now go, for I'm sending you to Pharaoh, and you're going to lead my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt," Moses kind of says, "I don't think so." Moses complains. He says, "Who am I to appear before Pharaoh?" Moses asks God, "How can you expect me to lead the Israelites out of Egypt? I can't do that." God says, "I'll be with you. That's how. I'm the one that's going to do it. You're going to be working for me." And Moses, he protested again. Look, they won't even believe me that you sent me to do this. They won't do what I tell them. They'll just say the Lord never appeared to you. Moses pleaded with the Lord. "I'm not a good speaker. I never have been, and I'm still not now. Even after you've spoken to me, I'm clumsy with words. I can't do this." God's like, "Who makes mouths?" the Lord asked. "Who makes people so they can speak or not speak, hear or not hear, see or not see? Is it not I, the Lord?" See, Moses thinks he's doubting himself here, but he's really doubting God, isn't he? His reluctance to step forward and accept this position is not humility. It's unbelief. And God kind of got angry at Moses and said, "Now just go, as I've told you, and I'll help you speak and I'll tell you what to say." But Moses still was pleading, "Lord, please send somebody else." Well, so yeah, you can identify with this guy. This is the guy that's, you know, not all gung-ho and everything. He's pretty reluctant to fill in this role. I think that's intriguing. So he's cited here as a man of faith, and yet it wasn't like his faith never flagged or never, you know, varied and was just solid all the way. Actually, there was unbelief in Moses' life. We read that it was by faith that Moses, when he grew up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. The reason for that, if you're not familiar with this story, is that his mom, instead of killing him as the order was, that males were supposed to be killed, hid him for 3 months, and then when he was too hard to hide, she makes this basket, puts tar and pitch on the bottom of it, puts him in that, puts a cover on it, and shoves him out onto the Nile River. Probably aiming it for the people that are swimming down there so that this basket will come down. And so happens that Pharaoh's daughter and her maids were out swimming in the Nile or bathing, and they see this basket come floating up. They go over there and check it out. It's a baby. Well, she wanted a baby, so she grabbed it and she says, "This is my baby now." Moses' sister, Jochebed, who had followed the basket down, pops up about that time. She says, "I'll bet you need somebody to nurse that baby, don't you? I could probably find someone like mom." And so they worked out a deal, and the mom got to nurse him, and he was eventually weaned, but he grew up as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, Pharaoh's grandson, in the palace. And so he, like some of these others, you know, there's this whole issue of privilege, wealth, power. You know, Egypt at this time was the greatest empire on earth. Easily the greatest empire on earth at this particular time. And Moses is sitting in the driver's seat in the empire of Egypt itself. Great privilege, great power. But we read that he chose to share the oppression of God's people instead of enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin. Moses knew who he was. He knew who God was too. And so we read that he went down there and started to side with the Hebrews. He wound up
killing an Egyptian that was beating a Hebrew up, got himself in trouble, had to flee. But the whole thing, it was a decision on his part. You know, all he had to do was just keep quiet and enjoy the money, the servants, the slave girls, everything else that would be his as the Pharaoh. Anything he wants at his command. And he chooses instead to go down and get tied up with the Hebrew slaves. So he chose to share the oppression of God's people instead of enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin. You know, this was going on right here in the book of Hebrews. This group that he was writing to were under some persecution. There was a lot of temptation in this group to play it safe, sort of not really let people know that you're a Christian, kind of go along with, you know, ritual Judaism, because that's what the neighbors are watching us. We got to do what they expect, or else we're going to be persecuted. We're going to be oppressed. And at one time, they were courageous enough to withstand that oppression, but lately it had gotten to the point where they would compromise their faith rather than risk censure from their neighbors. And that's part of the occasion for the writing of this book. And he's reminding them, what about Moses? He could have just kept quiet. And he could have been lived in that palace and grown up as one of the true great ones on earth. But he chose not to do that and go down and share the oppression of God's people rather than try to live for self. And so this is a big decision that God calls on a lot of people. And this is our second thing we see in the life of Moses, that he made a choice between the world and God. That's something the Bible teaches a lot. That we can look out here at our world and it's really a world system. The Bible teaches that the whole culture and system of that we live in is like a vast system. It's all based on a kind of an agreement of basic values. And that as followers of God, we have to make a conscious decision. Am I going to pursue the things of the world, or am I going to pursue the things of God? Because you cannot pursue both things. That's an either-or choice, not both and. In the New Testament, the Apostle John writes in 1 John 2, verse 15, do not love the world, the cosmos, the world system, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but it's from the world. And the world is passing away and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. So this is really the model that's set before us, biblically. You have two things here. The world system with its values. Lust, what I can get for me. The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh. And the boastful pride of life. That quest for prestige and for every admiration and everybody looking up to me. And these are the things that our world lives for. They're the antithesis of everything that God calls us to. Not for what I can lust for me, but for what I can give out of myself for others. Not how much boastful pride and prestige I can have, but how humble I can be to be like Jesus. I want to read a few comments from a book I'm working on Satan. And it has a section on this world system business. My opinion. It says, the church in the West has consistently failed to see avarice or greed and the quest for personal prestige as worldly. At least as long as they aren't taken too far. And the argument here is that in the church today, people refer to, well, that's very worldly. We wouldn't want to have anything to do with that. But they're very selective in what they consider to be worldly. You know, well, that's a dirty movie. That's worldly. We shouldn't go that. You know, drugs, that's worldly. We should stay away from worldly things like that. And so the church will identify certain things as worldly, usually gross sins of commission. But if we study what does the Bible teach about the world system, 80, 90% of the people that are locked in the grip, trapped by the world system, are trapped by the other part. Not the dirt, the filth, the vice, the bunco, but they're trapped by success, by the prestige, by the riches that the world offers. That's what draws people. And the church, I think, has a major problem today because we have redefined the world such that here is what's worldly, here is what our worldly people, and ignoring the whole, ignoring the biggest part of it, the part that we would probably get caught up in, we don't even consider that worldly in the Western world, the Western church. Interesting how many Christian parents are worried and angry about how the violence and sex in today's TV shows might affect their children. I don't know how many parents I've had come up to me commenting about that, how awful that is. And yet, isn't it interesting that many of those same parents have never spent a moment worrying about the influence advertising and shows exhibiting flagrant materialistic greed and glorifying wealth might have on their kids? Think about it. I'm not sure I've ever had a parent come up, actually, and say, you know, I'm just worried. I see my kids sitting there and watching these shows where the mansions are there and are out by the pool and driving the Maserati and talking about your investment portfolio, and it just worries me that they're going to be influenced. I never hear that from any parents. I never seem too worried about that. Why is that? Is it because we've redefined the world system so that it doesn't include the part that we like? Maybe? The result of exempting some aspects of the cosmos from our definition of worldly is an uneasy accommodation or compromise with the world system. Some values of the world are embraced while others are rejected. But the result is not 50% or even 30% spirituality. The result is a completely broken spirituality. No spirituality. Jesus warned, you cannot serve two masters. And this was in the context. Matthew 6, read the context for that statement of greed for wealth. Something that we have no problem with in the Western church. You know, we're so wealthy and affluent, we live in the most wealthy and affluent society ever. It just seems like, you know, we're only being reasonable here. Of course, I know someone who's greedy. This one over here, we always pick somebody more greedy than us, richer than us. That's what greed is. Look, they're just all carried away. My stuff here, come on, that's just reasonable. People starving to death in our world. We're just laying back in our spectacularly laid out pads. I meant to give a certain percentage this year, but, you know, too many bills. Bills because I spend so much on myself. And, you know, the interesting thing is, and Jesus predicts it in this passage, that if we try to just not actually make that decision, not make that either or decision, which is it going to be, but we try to strike a middle path, where I'll just sort of kind of do both. You cannot serve two masters, he says. You wind up despising one and cleaving to the other. And so we find that Christians, accommodated to the world, and in particular to greed and wealth, lose the love of the Father. Their heart starts to grow cold toward God. The Bible predicts that. We just read, didn't we? 1 John 2, where he said, if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. This whole system was set up by the evil one to trap people, to capture people. If anyone that thinks that's not dangerous, anyone who thinks we can wade out into the middle of the world system safely, has not taken the measure of this danger at all. James says that friendship with the world is enmity with God. He says, don't you know that if you're friends with the world, that makes you an enemy of God? Strong language in the New Testament on this subject. How could it be otherwise when we are compromising with the kingdom of Satan? If you understand what the Bible clearly teaches, when Jesus refers to the God of this world, now is the judgment of the God of this world. Who's he talking about? Satan. Satan is the one that set up the world system. It's his alternative to living for God. You can do this. You can live for lust. You can have prestige and admiration. You don't need that other stuff. Come and live for these things. That's what it was sap for. To capture people and steer them away from the inner hunger for God. To make them forget about their hunger for God. That's what it's for. No wonder God's not too happy when His own people want to strike a peace treaty with His enemy's kingdom. Satan knows that to the extent he can get Christians to compromise with the world, they'll become ineffective for God. He knows that. And that makes me think possibly that maybe here's one of the keys when we think of someone like a Moses. You know, he wasn't this paragon of faith, certainly not early in his life. And even late in his life, even at 80, he's sitting there telling God, no, 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 send someone else, right? I mean, he wasn't so perfect, but he did make that choice. There was an underlying decision on his part to give up his privileged life in favor of sharing the life with the people of God. If you want to serve the Lord, this stands right before you. And I think it's an absolute requirement. I've never seen anybody who's a compromiser with the world that was effective in serving God. If you want to have an effective ministry, this decision needs to be made. It needs to be made unambiguously, clearly, and unconditionally. God, I choose a life pursuing your things and not the things of the world. Of course I'll have to make a living. We have to do all of those things. We have to live in the middle of the world. There's never any option of getting out of the world for us. We're supposed to be in the middle of the world. Jesus said, I do not ask that you take them out of the world, only that you protect them from the evil one. But it's funny that making a living can be defined pretty broadly. And it's funny to see Christians defining making a living in such a way that there is no visible difference between their way of life and the way of life of their affluent, completely world-focused neighbors. They have all of the same things and live the same pattern. The outside viewer can really hardly see any difference, none at all. How can that be? How could it be that the world can see no difference between our way of life when we're living for God and His things and the way of life of those in the world who know nothing but lust and the boastful pride of life? Well, that's troubling. Verse 26 says, Moses thought it was better to suffer for the sake of Christ than to own the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his greater reward. Yeah, well, that's what faith is, right? He could either have the treasures that are right here and now, tangible, or this invisible part, this part that can't be seen, that's off in the future with God. And faith puts a value on that. That's more valuable. Now it's easy to miss the next part of this story, okay? Because usually the story goes from, you know, Moses has to run away from Pharaoh, and the next thing you know, he's coming in to free the people of Israel. And we forget that in between there slid a little period of 40 years. So again, like with Joseph, there's this pretty striking delay that comes into the story here. Man, all this time he's out there just wandering around in a semi-arid area being a shepherd. He got married and had a family, so that part was probably good. Must have wondered, though. Here was a guy raised with the best educated environment. You know, to be raised in the household of Pharaoh, you couldn't have been more educated in the ancient world than that. This guy would be like the top, one of the top scholars, you know, in our world today, for his day, comparatively. He's out here walking around with some sheep, you know, banging them with a stick. What am I doing out here? Well, he must have gotten seasoned out there. There must be some reason that God waited 40 years. Part of it was that Pharaoh died, the one that was after him, and everyone else that remembered his story, they all died. So that kind of opened the door to go back. I don't know whether Moses knew any of that was happening. Well, we read in 27, it was by faith that Moses left the land of Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He kept right on going because he kept his eyes on the one who is invisible. I think this is not referring to the first leaving of Egypt. This is actually referring to the main Exodus with all the people. Anyway, the point for us is he wasn't afraid of Pharaoh. And so another mark, a fourth characteristic here of faith that we're seeing in this biography is this courage that people can develop. You develop as this courage, you're not afraid, you know, because you do trust God. You do realize that my life's in His hands. And so a lot of the way people live in anxiety and they're all so self-protective and they have these fevers, oh man, what if this happened? Oh man, what if that happened? People who are really living their lives in a life of faith trust God. They're not scared like everyone else, and they'll do pretty courageous things. Even now, when he came back and confronted Pharaoh with God's demands, it's easy to miss that still there was not immediate success. Just the opposite. Things went poorly. We read that Pharaoh was angered by Moses' request, and so he told his slave masters, these guys, these Jews, must not have enough work to do if they're sitting around dreaming up projects like going out and into the wilderness with their God. They need to be busier. So just don't give them any straw anymore. Make them go get their own and chop it up for the bricks they're making, but make sure that they keep the same quota of bricks that they always did, not one brick less. And so they basically had their work added on to as slaves. And we read that the slave taskmasters whipped them mercilessly. If they were a single brick short, they would whip these people. And they got pretty angry at Moses. Moses got kind of angry too. He was very frustrated at this point, cried out to God in 5 of Exodus, "Why have you mistreated your own people like this? Lord, why did you send me? What am I doing here? Ever since I gave Pharaoh your message, he's been even more brutal to your people. You have not even begun to rescue them." I don't know how long this went on, but it must have been a certain amount of time just for him to even be saying that, right? Days, weeks, months, I don't know. But nothing happened. It didn't work out. You would expect now that I got God sending me in here, I can just like womp, 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 and boom, it's just going to happen. But no, it wasn't that way. It went the other way. It went south. And then Moses is still busting out with this. God's like, go back and tell your people this. He says, my own people won't even listen to me anymore. That's true. They were saying, may God damn you for bringing this extra work and the whipping and brutalizing that we're getting down on us. This is your fault. And they blamed him. He was the object of contempt of his own people that he was there to lead out. He says, how can I expect Pharaoh to listen? I'm not an orator. He's back to that point again. Well, eventually came the 10 plagues. And so things start to move rapidly at that point. And God eventually breaks the will of Pharaoh and he releases them. And in fact, the Egyptians are so glad to be rid of them by now, they say, here, you can just take some food and gold and everything else. They load them down and say, get out. 1.5 million people go walking away out into the desert. First comes the 10th plague. It was by faith we read that Moses commanded the people of Israel to keep the Passover and to sprinkle blood on the doorpost so that the angel of death would not kill their firstborn. Oh yeah, the Passover. That's when Passover got started, was during this episode. And this was the 10th plague where the firstborn would be killed in each household unless they celebrated Passover. And so we see another principle here in this Passover business that Moses trusted God's prescribed means of rescue and taught the other people to do the same. Passover is a picture of the death of Jesus Christ. A lot of people are not aware of this. You know, the Last Supper, communion, that was a Passover dinner. Okay? A lot of people are not aware that Jesus was crucified on the day of Passover. Yeah. He was a Passover lamb. This lamb would be killed for the family, and some of the blood displayed on the doorposts and lintels. So it was a picture of the fact that one day God would send his own lamb, that it was his blood, his death, that made it so that our people don't have to die. And when the angel of death would see the blood, he would pass over that household and go check and see if the next house had it. It's all a picture. Boy, that would be pretty convenient, wouldn't it? If Jesus just happened to arrange somehow to get the Romans to crucify him on the day of Passover. That isn't very likely. Jesus was the fulfillment of this, and it's a lesson that this is really very applicable to us today. The message of Passover is that God's going to come over your house, and he's going to say, why shouldn't you be judged? Why should I accept you? And you need to have blood on your door and lintel and post. Well, we don't need to do it literally anymore because this was only just a symbol. This was nothing but a picture. The real thing has come now. That's the message of Hebrews, right? Is that, you know, Passover was just a prediction of what God was ultimately going to do about human sin, that he was going to pay the price himself. But now we have to accept that gift. We have to accept God's prescribed way to come to him. And Passover is a picture of that. And so that was when the Egyptians said, all right, just get out. And we read in 29, it was by faith that the people of Israel went right through the Red Sea as though they were on dry ground. But when the Egyptians tried to follow, they all got drowned. And so this was the most massive miracle of the whole Old Testament. It comes up over and over again throughout the Old Testament. According to Paul, this was a picture of regeneration that first, they did Passover to signify how God would forgive sin. And it was when they passed through the Red Sea that sort of metaphorically stands as a picture of crossing over from Egypt, the world, into a relationship with God. And so it was very symbolic. And they kind of understood it that way too. You also see, you know, the Red Sea was a pretty big miracle. I used to be bothered by this story because I thought, you know, as modern people, are we supposed to believe this? I had a prof that was like, well, don't worry, he says, we've really learned that this is actually the Reed Sea. So you see, this was up at the end of the Red Sea, and this water was probably only 6 inches deep. That's how they got through there. And I'm sitting there thinking, good. Now all we have to explain is how the Egyptian army drowned in 6 inches of water. It's really not that easy to get around the issue of the miraculous, and you just start to realize if God is God, if we spell God with a big G instead of a little G, then a large miracle is no different than a small miracle to him. And this was a big one. We can also conclude that when we're walking by faith, you might have to do the dangerous thing sometimes. God might call you to do something that seems kind of risky. Remember that scene? Did you ever watch the movie, The Ten Commandments? Yeah, Charlton Heston, and he calls out, and boom, I remember seeing that when I was a kid. That was something. And so you have this walls of water. It says they walk between the walls of water, so I don't think the six-inch thing is very, very right on at all. That doesn't look too safe, going down in there. They only had a few options at this point. They could go and maybe either fight the Egyptians or maybe just go and surrender. Maybe, you know, the Egyptians liked having slaves. They might take them back. Things might work out. You never know. Maybe we can take them. Maybe we should go try to take them on. They could go walking down into that hole, which looks kind of risky. I don't know how many slaves knew how to swim. I've never seen anything like this before, never done anything like that before, walking down in here, but that's one of their options there. Or maybe we should just hang out here and see how this works out, you know, because, I mean, there's that fire thing is blocking the Egyptians, so that doesn't look too bad, and, you know, maybe we should just stay right here where we're still alive. Well, of course, two of these options were completely wrong, and God was saying, go down in there. And so they go running down in. And I think it's kind of an interesting picture to ponder. We can look at it and say, well, that's no big deal. I mean, just go through there. I think it would have been a big deal. I would have been a little nervous about that, to be sure. Well,
God will certainly call on us if we want to follow Him. Part of faith in God means doing sometimes some things that make you pretty nervous. They take you right outside of anything you've ever done before, outside of your comfort zone, into something that might be pretty scary. All of these people, we read the summary later in the chapter, all these people we have mentioned received God's approval because of their faith, and yet none of them received all that God had promised. That's right, because you know this whole thing was actually headed toward the climax of the story of the Bible, which was Christ Himself. None of them got to see that. And we read that God had far better things in mind for us that would also benefit them, because they can't receive the prize at the end of the race until we finish the race. And so this story that we're contemplating in Hebrews 11 is not over, okay? We're still in the middle of the story. And one of the points he's making here is that even these righteous saints of old are waiting for us to finish the story. Yeah, the big climax has come because Jesus has come, and now we understand what this is all about. You know, we're not confused about things like Passover and all these other things we've studied here in Hebrews. We see what it all means. It's all about Jesus Christ. But God's not done. Now we live in an age where God wants to include as many people as possible into this colossal plan that He's working on. Let's wrap this up. What have we seen? First of all, we need to consider that God is an eternal being, right? He's always been there. If you go back umpteen trillion years, God was there. And He was just as old then as He is now. There is no age with God. He is from everlasting to everlasting, as the Bible puts it. When you're a being like that, things look a little different than they do from our perspective. Temporal beings with just a very short lifespan so far. And one of the effects it tends to have is that He's not in quite as much a hurry as we tend to be. You know, when you've been around like forever, you know, waiting a few days or even a few years just doesn't seem like that big a deal. He's not even locked into time like we are. So you do see a different timetable at work a lot of times when it comes to God. We have to get used to that fact. He's not working on our schedule. He works from eternity and for eternity, and that tends to mean that He's prepared to take a little time along the way. That sure happened with these guys, huh? And yet, the whole time He was developing His plan, there was never a point where God was like, oh yeah, let's get back to what we were doing. That was never the case. Right through this whole narrative, God's plan was being developed and pursued. He was moving toward His goals here on earth. They couldn't see that. Didn't seem like that. Didn't seem like He was doing much of anything. To sit there for 40 years? I'm not even that much older than that. If you believe that. I remember being 40. How about that? I thought I'd been alive a long time. I can't imagine. 40 years of waiting seemed like God just totally lost the thread here. Nothing's happening. Oh, yeah. He was working the whole time. We don't always see what He's doing. We don't understand His timetable. That's why God calls on us to persevere. These great men and women of faith that we're reading about, they persevered through lengthy times. How about Abraham with that 25-year wait on the business with Isaac and everything? Yeah, and in fact, that He's still developing His plan today. He'll call on us sometimes. You know, the life of faith includes a certain amount of frustration at times because we want God to work on our timetable, and that's not the way it works. And that's one of the things that we should really take home here tonight. I don't know whether God may have called you. Maybe you're in one of these things where you feel like, man, I've been putting out now for some time. I've been trying to serve the Lord. It doesn't seem to be working at all. The last time I had success was probably a couple years back. I feel sorry for you. That's terrible. Of course, nowhere near as bad as some of these guys. Huh? And God was still pursuing His plan. That's what's important. Yeah, He may let you sit for a period of time without any apparent action.
He'll do that kind of stuff. Because that's his perspective, working from eternity. And he's not on our schedule. Well, I'm just going to finish up right there for tonight. Who has a thought to add or a question about this? Maybe your own experience on it.
That was kind of hard to listen to. I mean, it was really awesome, but Dennis, in my mind, I want to serve the Lord, and yet I feel like I have the attention span of a gnat when it comes to spiritual things. I mean, 40 years? Like, I think I was just in prayer group last week talking to my friends about these cool things that God's doing in my life, and today I spent all day feeling sorry for myself. Like, what do you do? I just feel so, I can't do this. Help.
Well, I know what you're saying. I mean, that's the way I tend to feel when I read this too. I don't know how they do it. But I think it's helpful to read, and that can maybe help us to recalibrate our thinking a little bit, get out of this sort of demanding expectation or mentality. Partly, I think one of the things that matures us is that God does put us into the waiting pattern and kind of compels us to wait, and that's what teaches us some of the key lessons in concerning faith. But, yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, you read about it, and it just seems like a bar that's way too high to get over. So I guess we plead to God and keep reading Hebrews. Maybe that'll help.
So I'm a nice big materialist, and so that was a really uncomfortable part of your teaching. But I guess I've always believed that you need to always be experiencing a certain level of tension, being frogs in this pot of water that keeps, you know, increasing and boiling. And how do you know that, you know, you are committing yourself to God? I mean, I don't know if there's no formula, but I was wondering if you could throw out a few ideas to keep yourself in check, just because it's just a constant struggle.
Well, you know, it is very difficult, and even to tell when you're losing it, and Jesus predicted that too. In that passage in Matthew 6, he says, you know, when the lamp of the body is the eye, but when the lamp of your body goes dark, that's real darkness. And what he was saying is that serving greed and wealth actually changes your perception. You can't even see any longer that you've got the problem. That's one of the most devastating parts about this. One of the things I notice is that people who are living for greed never seem to have time for the things of God. They're so busy, 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 making wealth and enjoying all of their wealth and things. And I really can't be troubled with this or troubled with that. It's a lot of it comes around that way. You know, people start to feel like, well, you know, one of my man hours is worth $100. So what, I'm just going to waste five hours out here doing this or doing that? We just feel like we're just too rich for that. We're too good for that. Compromised Christians, too busy for the things of God. There's also the issue of how in touch you are with the need of the world and whether your heart burns to see the will of God done. A healthy Christian should feel a tension in their life on this issue of materialistic greed. We should sense, I'm struggling against this and it hurts. The person you really worry about is the person that's like, I don't see anything, like I'm not struggling. Well, that's probably because you gave in so much that you completely lost it. A healthy believer should be feeling the pull of the world system. There's nothing wrong with feeling that. In fact, that's a good sign. You know, it's like when you're floating with the current, it just seems like there isn't any current. But when you try to stand up in the river, if you've ever done the tubing before and you stand up, that current bowls you over. You feel it's really strong current out here, but I couldn't feel it when I was just floating along with it. So this is one of the things. Is there a struggle? Are we even conscious of any struggle on our part? Or do we just blindly accept every latest thing that I have to own, everything that I have to buy for my kids, every activity that's foisted upon me by the world system, and I just accept everything that comes along and there's no struggle? That's bad. So if I'm struggling, if my heart burns to see the will of God done, and I feel that I cannot rest easy unless I see God using me in some way, And if I'm making time for the things of God, and instead of saying I can't do that because I have to do the other, when I don't really have to do the other, I'm just deciding to do the other. You know, sometimes the things of the world always trump the things of God. It's like I can't make it to the retreat because I have to. And the have to is just something to do with the world. And so I wouldn't want to say no to the world, of course. That would be really rude. That might not sit well at work if I said no to that. So we'll just say no to the things of God instead. A lot of people live that way. How about over here?
I can appreciate the message of waiting on God, patience, perseverance. But these stories where there's 20 or 40 years of waiting makes it sound like there's not an ongoing relationship with God. If we're entering into a relationship with God, what are we to expect? Some feedback along the way? Are we really interacting with God, or are we just is there a dead space for 20 or 40 years in these cases?
Well, I don't think it's a complete dead space, but it's it often feels kind of dead in the sense that the key thing that I really feel needs to happen is the thing that's not happening. I mean, yeah, other things are happening. If you study Abraham's life, you know, he was out there, had meetings with God, and was offering sacrifices and having a family. I mean, I'm sure that, yeah, there is a relationship with God, but it's still very frustrating when the thing that your heart knows is the right thing. And in this case, the advancing the mission that God's given us to do here, and that part doesn't seem to be moving forward. It kills you. Now, these are Old Testament stories. I can't think of a 20 or 40 year episode in the New Testament, but I'm sure that we will be called to wait longer than we had in mind at times. Hopefully not 40 years. Well, it's getting kind of late, so I think we better wrap up. Lord, the more we read about this life of faith, the more challenging it sounds. This is not too easy. We thank you that we get to, as members of the body of Christ, we get to have the support of fellow believers that are waiting here with us and struggling with us. That's really nice. Thank you that we don't have it as rough as some of these guys did. And still we feel weak. We still feel like the bars are way up there where we can't reach this, Lord. All we can do is just present ourselves to you in all of our weakness. I remember that passage where Moses was telling you, how am I going to lead people out of Egypt? How am I supposed to do something like that? And you told him, I'll be with you. That's what we have too, God. You're with us. And so the things that you're calling us to here today, building your kingdom, you're with us. We believe that. And we're going to live our lives based on that, Lord. Help us, Lord, in our unbelief when we fall into that, and in our impatience as well. Teach us what this means to really be stayed on you in true faith and trust. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.